You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My name is George Perkovich. I'm a vice president for studies here at the Endowment. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you here this afternoon. We're basically here on the occasion of the publication of James Acton's latest work, the policy outlook that you have here, Deterring Safeguards Violations. James has been with us for a little over a year now. He has a PhD in physics from Cambridge University. For those of you, this is kind of a joke, but that's a university in the United Kingdom. It's kind of new and an upcoming university and has a lot of potential. We were delighted to be able to recruit James to join us, and then I've had the pleasure of working with him very intensively over the last year. We've co-authored an Adelphi paper on abolishing nuclear weapons and co-edited a book that includes a debate on that paper and the topic of nuclear weapons abolition. Indeed, I see at least one of the contributors to that debate here, Achille Sawar. And then James is continuing to do some very interesting both research and analysis, and I think the paper before you and the subject of his presentation, the question of deterring safeguards violations, is extremely important and timely, both in terms of the UN meeting this week and the resolution that's been adopted, which represents an attempt by the states to kind of to creep up and advance the strengthening both of the safeguards regime, but also the enforcement mechanisms surrounding that. Doesn't go as far as I think many would wish or would argue is actually necessary in a world where it is hoped that nuclear industry will expand more globally. But it is progress, and I think what you'll hear from James are some further ideas that move in that direction, while recognizing all of the rights under the NPT, under each article of the NPT, but further kind of defining what it actually means to do peaceful nuclear energy and what ought to happen to strengthen that boundary between peaceful and military. So I'm looking forward to James's presentation. I unfortunately have to leave somewhere in the middle of this to go to New York to catch a plane to go someplace else. And so James will, in a sense, kind of monitor or moderate the discussion and the Q&A. And if anybody gets out of line, Achilles is going to be the enforcer. He doesn't know that, but I've just deputized him. And he comes with an associate, so there's two of them. So everybody has to behave. Which I'm sure won't be difficult. And so, James, I turn it over to you. Thank you again for coming.
Thanks, George. The central problem with the non-proliferation regime, as far as I see it, is the inability of the international community to react quickly and robustly when a state breaks the rules. And we see that very clearly in the debates on the Security Council. The starting point is whether the Security Council should do anything in the event that a state has violated its non-proliferation obligations. And this whether to do anything debate can take literally years before you get onto the debate of what you should do. And this very long delay, this kind of often agonizing over whether safeguards violations matter, significantly undermines the deterrence value of IAEA safeguards. And this is particularly serious in not just in and of itself, but if there is going to be a nuclear renaissance, then to avoid that turning into what might be termed a proliferation renaissance, states are going to have to believe and understand that if they break the rules, there will be consequences, and those consequences will be rapid and they will be robust. So that framing of the problem puts enforcement square and center as the key non-proliferation challenge. That, as I see it, is the weakest link in the non-proliferation regime, not the IAEA's verification capabilities, which, although they could be improved, I see in a relative sense as being much stronger than the international community's ability to respond to non-compliance. And it's not just me that thinks that. I mean, in the case of President Obama's speech last April, as many of you will know, he's talking about the inability of the international community to enforce the regime. The president said rules must be binding, violations must be punished, words must mean something. In his much more British and understated way, Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, in reference to safeguards, said it should be assumed that sanctions would be imposed in response to anything other than the most minor of breaches. The question is how to advance that goal in practical terms. How can you improve the enforcement of the non-proliferation regime? And the 2010 review conference, I think, provides a clear opportunity to try and advance that goal if you find the right way round. The 2010 review conference is important because it provides a key test of the president's new strategy for dealing with nuclear dangers. The idea, as many of you will know, is for the US and the other weapon states to say, we are going to take the idea of a world free of nuclear weapons very seriously, and we are going to advance practical steps towards that goal. And in return, we're going to hope that the non-nuclear weapon states, not the Irans and the North Koreas, but the 180-odd non-nuclear weapon states that are in compliance with their obligation, we're going to hope that they are going to go above and beyond the bare minimum of their legal requirements and are going to enhance the safeguards regime, are going to enhance non-proliferation, are going to enhance enforcement. And there's a robust debate, as many of you know, about whether this strategy is likely to work. Many of us would argue that the Security Council resolution that was passed today is the first evidence that such a strategy can be made to work, modest as the resolution was. But the 2010 review conference clearly provides a goal, a much more trying and testing goal opportunity to test whether that strategy is going to work. But it's necessary to tailor what you want to achieve at the review conference very carefully. It's very unlikely, for instance, that all states are going to agree to the additional protocol at the review conference. I think extremely unlikely, which is an enhanced safeguards document. Similarly, debates about export controls, which is something else you'd like to enhance, take place within the nuclear suppliers group. The review conference is also not the right forum for addressing individual specific cases of non-compliance, like Iran or North Korea. But it is the right forum for addressing the structural problems in the regime and for dealing with non-compliance, creating red lines that will help prevent other Irans and other North Koreas in future. I think it's also the right forum for dealing with the issue of withdrawal and responding to withdrawal, but that's not the topic of today's talk. So I see there as being a political opportunity that's been opened up by the president's strategy for dealing with the problem of non-compliance and enforcing non-compliance at the review conference. What I'd like to dwell on first, though, is why take safeguards violations seriously at all? Do safeguards violations matter? And I think many of you are sitting there thinking, well, they obviously do, and I'm preaching to the choir here. But one thing I want to point out is the United States hasn't always taken safeguards violations seriously in the past. When South Korea was found to have violated its safeguards agreement in actually some quite serious ways, the United States played a very active role behind the scenes in ensuring that South Korea was not found in non-compliance with its obligations. And the reason that the Board of Governors gave at the time was that the, quote, the quantities of nuclear material involved have not been significant. The problem is, of course, that the quantities of nuclear material involved in South Korea's actions were almost identical to the quantities involved in Iran's actions. So the idea that we can overlook safeguards violations if they involve small quantities of nuclear material is wrong, because you can do very significant research and development with small quantities of nuclear material. But B, it also leads us to an impossible situation where you're treating one country one way and another country the other way. Iran also provides another example of, I think, where, and this criticism doesn't apply against the US, but it does apply against other states and many in the NGO movement who have been very inclined to forgive Iran's safeguards violations. Very often you hear people say, people quote the fact that since November 2004, every single report of the IAEA has said that there has been no diversion of declared nuclear material in Iran. And the implication behind that is that what we really care about is diversion. When safeguards violations involve the diversion of nuclear material, that we really ought to care about. Where safeguards violations involve small technical mistakes, like reporting failures or refusals to give inspectors access, that kind of stuff we can ignore. Again, I want to argue against that attitude. I think it's a mistake. I think it's very short-sighted. From a legal perspective, there is no difference often between a diversion and a reporting failure. If you have failed to report on the use of nuclear material fully, then within the meaning of the IAEA statute and the other legal documents, you have diverted that nuclear material. So trying to say that Iran's actions were just a minor reporting failure but not diversion is actually legally wrong. Iran did divert nuclear material. And that's why every IAEA report before November 2004 does not contain the claim that there was no diversion of nuclear material, because there was diversion of nuclear material before that date. So the idea that kind of safeguards failures like reporting errors or access refusals are kind of minor things that we can sweep under the carpet, I think is because they're not diversion. I think that's wrong. But at a much more general level, one of the things that George is very fond of remarking upon is that the NPT contains four pillars, not just three. Apart from disarmament, non-proliferation, and the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, security is the kind of tacit fourth pillar of the NPT. The basic security bargain behind the treaty, as everybody knows, is I have no need to develop nuclear weapons if I'm confident of the fact that my neighbors aren't developing nuclear weapons. And my neighbors have no need to develop nuclear weapons if they're confident of the fact that I'm not doing so. And safeguards and the transparency regime created by safeguards is essential and vital to the security pillar of the NPT. Reassuring states that others aren't breaking the rules is necessary for the treaty's security logic to hold. So not only is kind of from a narrow legal perspective overlooking safeguards violations a mistake, but from a much broader policy perspective, safeguards violations need to be taken seriously and dealt with much more alacrity. So having kind of outlined the scope of the problem, the challenge, of course, is to work out in practical terms how to make safeguards violations matter, how to get the international community to deal with them much more seriously. And part of the problem, and I by no means claim this is the whole problem, but part of the problem is that there's no legal consensus on whether safeguards violations are NPT violations. The point can and has been argued both ways. But more than that, that problem is exacerbated because there's a sense out there among many states that NPT violations matter and safeguards violations don't matter. So the fact that the two aren't necessarily equivalent to one another, and there's this kind of sense out there that safeguards violations don't matter, gives states an excuse not to act. And indeed, this is exactly the Russian argument, which is used behind the scenes time and time again. Iran hasn't violated the NPT. The NPT is the really serious thing, and the Russians use that as being an argument continually against sanctioning Iran. So what's the legal issue here? I mean, I want to briefly examine the legal arguments for and against whether safeguards violations do constitute NPT violations.
The buzzing in the microphone, if somebody has their cell phone still on or their BlackBerry or whatever, and so when you get that interference and cackling, that's what it's for. So if everybody could please shut down whatever electronic devices fit that category, that'd be great. Sorry.
Thanks, George. So I'd like to look briefly at the legal arguments as to whether safeguards violations do constitute a violation of the NPT. Well, Article 3 of the NPT obliges states to, quote, accept safeguards. And the argument is, for those who do argue that safeguards violations are NPT violations, that accepting safeguards involves abiding by them. If you're not abiding by your safeguards, then you're not accepting them. And so under that interpretation, safeguards violations necessarily constitute non-compliance with Article 3 of the NPT. This is certainly the approach that a number of people have agreed with. I mean, John Carlson, who's a respected Australian safeguards expert, has written that. Others like Chris Ford have argued that in the US. The argument on the other side is to point to a subtle difference in wording between the safeguards agreement and the NPT. The NPT says that the aim of safeguards is to detect, quote, the diversion of nuclear energy from peaceful purposes to nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices. The safeguards agreement uses almost exactly the same words, but adds "or for purposes unknown" on the end of it. So the argument is that if the IAEA detects non-compliance, but can't prove why that non-compliance has taken place, then it's a safeguards violation, but not an NPT violation. To be an NPT violation, you have to prove that the non-compliance was orientated towards a nuclear weapons program. For purposes unknown, the argument is it's safeguards violation, but not NPT violations. Well, again, you can argue about whether this is right or wrong. I mean, the lawyers point to a legal principle known as lex specialis derogat lex generali, which means a more specific agreement supersedes a less specific one. So you interpret things like the NPT in light of the subsequent agreement of the safeguards agreement. But, you know, even the US acknowledges that in some circumstances, safeguards violations might not be Article 3 violations. The US document that it publishes every few years on compliance with agreements acknowledges in theory there is potentially a difference between the two of them. So I would submit to you that although the case for is much stronger, although I think there is a very strong legal argument that safeguards violations are NPT violations, that there is some ambiguity here. And this seems to me something very usefully that the review conference could address. So specifically what I argue is that the review conference should clarify and emphasize that in future, all safeguards violations will be considered Article 3 violations. Let me elaborate about a couple of the effects that this such a declaration would and wouldn't have. It would not in any way interfere with the freedom of the Security Council to deal with safeguards violations in the way that it saw fit. If the Security Council thought that a state had been actively and proactively cooperating with the IAEA, the Security Council could still commend the state for its cooperation and not impose any punitive action. If the Security Council felt that sanctions were the right thing to do, it could still do that. This wouldn't mandate any particular course of Security Council action. What it would help do, though, is make it much harder for the Security Council to do nothing. If there were agreement that safeguards violations were Article 3 violations, the argument that they're not serious so they can be overlooked, I think, would be substantially undercut. So I don't in any way claim this is a panacea. I don't claim that it's going to lead to immediate and effective enforcement. But what I do claim is it might help shape the debate on the Security Council and make it much harder for the Security Council to do nothing. Second thing I want to point out is this is not in any way an amendment to the NPT. The review conferences have clarified the meaning of the NPT in cases in the past. Perhaps the most notable occasion is in reference to Article 4 of the NPT. As many of you know, Article 4 says nothing in this treaty shall be interpreted as affecting the inalienable right of all the parties to the treaty to develop research, production, and use of nuclear energy for peaceful purposes without discrimination and in conformities with Article 1 and 2 of this treaty. Article 4 of the NPT doesn't condition these rights on compliance with Article 3. But in the 2000 final declaration, exactly the same language was used, but the words "and Article 3" was added on at the end. So again, this was an example of a time when the review conference clarified the meaning of the NPT, by kind of confirming that Article 4 rights only exist in conformity with Article 3. That wasn't amendment, it was a clarification, and that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm envisaging. But I think there's an argument then for the review conference to go even further. Article 2 of the NPT is the kind of core injunction on non-nuclear weapon states. It's the injunction to not manufacture or otherwise acquire nuclear weapons. And Article 2 is the core obligation. Violations of Article 2 are the least likely to be overlooked. And again, there's a legal debate about the connection between safeguards violations and Article 2 violations. The United States argues that because Iran has violated its safeguards agreement, the pattern of violations indicates the intent to manufacture nuclear weapons. The US has argued that Iran has violated Article 2. Russia has strongly disagreed with that, and the former president, Mr. Putin, on a number of occasions has publicly stated there's no intent on Iran, there's no proof of Iran's intention to manufacture nuclear weapons. And that wording was chosen very, very carefully. That wording is specifically the Russian way of indicating that Iran didn't, in their opinion, hasn't violated Article 2 of the NPT, and hence gives Russia a reason not to impose tougher sanctions on Iran. So it seems to me that what you want to do is connect the most serious safeguards violations, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But it would be very useful if the review conference could agree that the most serious safeguards violations would be assumed to be Article 2 violations. That is, where a state violates its safeguards agreements in the most serious way, the international community will assume that it has the intention to manufacture nuclear weapons. I want to kind of amplify a bit on what the legal justification is for coupling Article 2 violations to the most serious safeguards violations. As I mentioned earlier, Article 2 is the injunction not to manufacture nuclear weapons, but Article 2 doesn't define what manufacture means. That's defined as part of the negotiating history of the treaty. And specifically, the interpretation is, quote, facts indicating that the purpose of a particular activity was the acquisition of a nuclear explosive device would tend to show non-compliance. That is, if a state is conducting a particular activity with the intention of manufacturing nuclear weapons, it's non-compliant with Article 2. The problem is, assessing intent is virtually impossible. Look at the argument today over the reason why Iran is conducting its enrichment program. I mean, if Iran is conducting its enrichment program to manufacture nuclear weapons, that's an Article 2 violation. If it's conducting its enrichment program for exclusively peaceful purposes, that's not an Article 2 violation. But of course, nobody can agree internationally. States can't agree on why this activity is taking place. So the kind of traditional interpretation of Article 2 is just absolutely unusable. You could only ever prove that a state had violated Article 2 when it was much too late to do anything about it. I mean, you could prove that a state had the intention to manufacture nuclear weapons if it detonated a nuclear explosion, but it's too late to do anything by then about it. So the remedy that I suggest here is for the international community to say, look, if you commit the most serious safeguards violations, we will interpret that as evidence of your intention to manufacture nuclear weapons. And we will act accordingly. Again, just to emphasize, this would not mandate any particular course of Security Council action, but it would help change the starting place within the debate. Of course, to be useful, the review conference would have to agree on what most serious means. What kind of safeguards violations are the most serious? And I would like to suggest that there are three different violations, types of violations, which should fall within this category. Number one, if a state diverts one significant quantity of nuclear material or more to an undeclared or unsafeguarded facility, that should be considered one of the most serious violations. And that should apply whether or not the diversion was in one big batch or multiple smaller batches. The diversion of one SQ or more to an undeclared or unsafeguarded facility seems to me to fall within this category. Number two, if a state unilaterally terminates its safeguards agreement, so if or safeguards on a particular facility, so if a state says, we're just not implementing safeguards on this facility anymore, that would seem to me to fall within the category of most serious. And thirdly, and most importantly, the failure to declare the construction of an enrichment or reprocessing plant. If a state is building the means to produce directly weapons-usable fissile material and it's not declaring that to the IAEA, that also seems to me to fall within this category. What I want to point out is I think it is virtually impossible for a state to build a nuclear weapon without doing one of these things. Either it has to divert the material it's going to weaponize to somewhere the IAEA doesn't know about, or it's going to terminate safeguards, or it's going to build an undeclared program. It could, in theory, do its weaponization in safeguarded, inspected facility, but that seems to me to be so unlikely as it can potentially be discounted. So if a state does one of those things, then that would constitute this category of the most serious violations. I want to point out that of those three is by far the most likely. That is, the construction of a clandestine enrichment or reprocessing facility is by far the most likely route for a state to follow in manufacturing nuclear weapons. I mean, certainly that's been the case historically. Of the five non-nuclear weapon states who have been found in non-compliance with their safeguards obligations, the DPRK, Iran, Iraq, Libya, and Romania, four of those, i.e. all of those except Romania, had large undeclared elements to their program. The problem, of course, is that it can be very difficult to spot undeclared facilities, particularly undeclared centrifuge facilities. I mean, that's the absolute hardest thing to spot. So if we're thinking about how deterrence works, there's kind of two components to deterring safeguards violations. First is you have to have some probability of detecting the violation, and secondly, you have to have consequences for doing so. And the lower the probability of detecting a violation is, the higher the consequences have to be in order to maintain the deterrence value of safeguards. So if you're thinking about how to deter states from building undeclared enrichment or reprocessing facilities in a world in which it's very hard to detect some of them, you're accepting the fact that the probability of detecting the violation is low. So the consequences, if you are detected, really need to be high. And that seems to me the particular value in associating the most serious safeguards violations with Article 2 violations. That seems to me to be some way of signaling to states, if you do go out and build clandestine facilities and you are caught, there are going to be real consequences for you doing so. So those are the kind of two areas that I'm suggesting the review conference looks at. It should, in the case of safeguards violations, say that in future all safeguards violations will be Article 3 violations, and that the most serious will be assumed to be Article 2 violations as well. What I'd kind of like to reflect on at the end is why this is worth pursuing. Why, with the limited time to prepare for the review conference, the limited political capital that diplomats will necessarily have to play with ahead of the review conference, why these particular measures are worth pursuing ahead of 2010. So the first thing I want to point out is that non-compliance matters. Non-compliance with safeguards is a threat to the NPT. And that while it's very, very important to deal with the problem cases, to deal with Iran and North Korea as they arise, what the review conference also needs to be looking at are structural ways to avoid these kind of problems arising again. And deterrence is the key there. Secondly, so not only is non-compliance an important subject to tackle at the review conference, but I think it's a good subject to tackle as well. It has no additional obligations for non-nuclear weapon states that are abiding by their obligations. Unlike many of the other steps that in the long run some of the nuclear weapon states say that they would like to move towards, dealing with non-compliance more robustly has absolutely no effect whatsoever, no negative effect on non-nuclear weapon states in agreement with, in compliance with their obligations. On the contrary, it enhances the security of non-nuclear weapon states. As I've explained before, safeguards are integral to the security pillar of the NPT. And so this is something which can be sold as enhancing the security of non-nuclear weapon states, because it does. Looking at the even bigger picture, I think we need to move towards a country-neutral approach for dealing with non-compliance. The unfortunate reality today is that the response to non-compliance depends as much on who you are as on what you did. I don't want to claim that South Korea's safeguards violations were as serious as Iran's violations, because they weren't by a long shot. But nonetheless, they were serious enough to merit non-compliance. And in the long run, it undermines the integrity of the NPT if states are dealt with in a discriminatory manner. If powerful states on the Security Council are willing to defend their friends and allies, then many non-nuclear weapon states who object to this kind of discrimination are simply not going to take part in enforcement actions in future. This is by no means the only reason why non-nuclear weapon states have not been as robust as they could be in responding to Iran and North Korea, but it is part of the picture. And so one of the things that my colleague Pierre Goldschmidt, the former Deputy Director General, has argued is that you need to develop country-neutral means of responding to non-compliance. To kind of borrow an analogy from domestic political philosophy, we ought to be considering how to deal with safeguards violations under a veil of ignorance. Without knowing who the next safeguards violator is going to be, we should start to agree upon what the blueprint for dealing with them should be. And you might be able to get some kind of agreement on how to deal with safeguards violators if you don't know who the next one is. As soon as you know who that is, the process becomes hopelessly politicized and unwieldy. But agreeing on general principles before you know who the next safeguards violator is, I think, is a very useful and important direction to move in. And the two proposals that I've explained today, I think, tie in with that aim nicely. By equating safeguards violations to NPT violations, it makes it much harder for anybody to overlook those violations, for any state to overlook those violations, irrespective of who its friends and allies are. With that, I'm now open to taking any questions. At the back on the far left, as I'm looking at it.
Victoria Kupchinetsky, I'm with the Voice of America. What is your reaction to this statement by President Medvedev yesterday that under very special extreme circumstances, sanctions can be imposed on a country?
I took that as being a positive statement. I'm somebody who believes that if the Iranian offer to negotiate turns out to be hollow, if Iran turns out to be willing to negotiate in good faith, fantastic. If it doesn't turn out to be willing to negotiate in good faith, then I think that enhancing Security Council sanctions is a necessary element for dealing with the situation. So I hope that what President Medvedev was signaling is a willingness to enhance sanctions if Iran isn't negotiating in good faith. And I hope that if the offer turns out not to have been in good faith, that Russia will then act upon that. Ed at the back.
James, it seems that the definition of most serious is going to be kind of problematic. But I wanted to offer maybe one other category that you might want to consider other than these smoking guns. But what if there's a repeated pattern of minor violations that look like they're willful? Just taking an analogy from safety, if the NRC just chased after the most blatant violations, they would miss patterns that might laying the groundwork for a sudden major violation. So is there a way to characterize repeated willful violations that are below the threshold, so to speak?
I think that's a very interesting and very useful idea. I was, in trying to think up how to define the most serious safeguards violations, I was trying to think up some kind of category that might conceivably be amenable to states at the review conference. Now, I recognize even what I've done here would be extremely hard for some states at the review conference to swallow. And the more you add to those categories, the harder it is to approach any kind of agreement on that. So it's kind of a matter of, I agree with you that patterns of violations can be as serious as individual big violations. But it seems to me, if you do present this, there's a balance between expanding the definition of most serious to include everything you want it to, and being able to get any kind of agreement at all. So in answer to your question, I mean, of course, in practice, all these things would be negotiated. And I hope that that kind of suggestion, if these ideas are taken up, would be considered as part of the mix and to see whether you could get any agreement on that. Yes, sir.
My name is Norman Wolf. I'm formerly at the State Department. Certainly, I found myself very much in agreement with virtually everything you said. I would add to perhaps part of the problem being the IAEA itself. I think it has gotten itself very politicized in its dealings with Iran. I point to specifically its finding, and I think it was 2002, that they found no evidence of a weapons program. What they meant to say, or should have said, is they found no evidence of weaponization. But certainly, up until that time, no one had ever thought there was such a thing as a covert, peaceful nuclear program. The IAEA has invented such a thing, apparently. So I think we need a stronger secretariat, number one. And the question, I guess, I have, I keep thinking that of the 190 parties to the NPT, 155 usually show up. Getting a consensus out of that thing is got to be harder than trying to get a consensus out of the Security Council. Have you picked the right forum to try to, shall I say, add a greater clarity?
Let me deal with the first part of your question first. I absolutely agree with you that there are multiple challenges with enforcing safeguards. I mean, number one is to get the IAEA to call non-compliance, and escalate it to the level of the Board of Governors at the appropriate time. Number two is then to get the Board of Governors to confirm the finding of non-compliance. Number three is then to get the Security Council to agree that something needs to be done. And number four is then to actually find something effective that needs to be done. So it's a multiple linked process. I'm only trying to do something really with link number three on that process. Pierre especially has Pierre Goldschmidt has written a lot about what you can do with the first and second links, getting the agency to call non-compliance, and getting the Board of Governors to agree that to confirm a finding of non-compliance in good time. So I absolutely agree with you. This is a multifaceted problem, and I'm only trying to target kind of one link on this chain. In terms of have I got the right forum, the answer is I don't know. I think the problem, and you know, if you could get the Security Council to agree on these measures, then I would be delighted by that as well. But the specific kind of factors that motivated me to think about this in the context of the review conference were really twofold. Firstly, non-nuclear weapon states have been saying for a long time that we're not going to do more on non-proliferation until the weapon states have done more on disarmament. If the nuclear weapon states do what they've said they're going to do on disarmament, and I fully understand that from the point of view of non-weapon states, there are concerns that that's going to be fulfilled, and if the non-weapon states are serious, that they're willing to do more on non-proliferation for disarmament, if both of those factors are true, then my hope is that it will open up a window of opportunity at the review conference. Whether that window will be large enough this time around, I don't know. But it doesn't seem to me impossible that there won't be room for maneuver. And I think that non-compliance is a really good thing to focus on at the review conference because it has no negative implications for non-nuclear weapon states abiding by their obligations. But it's hard to think about what the review conference can do about non-compliance. I mean, you're not going to get vague statements like the review conference thinks you ought to enforce the rules better. It's got to be targeted around the language of the treaty more. So that was kind of the political space, the niche that I was trying to fill. Whether the weapon states and others feel that there's genuine room to make progress on this kind of initiative remains to be seen. Greg, yeah. Sorry, there's a microphone just coming behind you.
Greg Tillman. I wondered if you could help us understand your proposals a little bit better by just plugging it into a historical event, and I'm thinking of the Syrian covert attempt to build a nuclear reactor. If one accepts the general time frame of the U.S. having concluded several months prior to Israel's attack that this was a nuclear reactor, and remembering that it took the U.S. government 7.5 months after the attack before it went to the IAEA, one assumes that was because they thought that the IAEA would have been slow and the consequences of this exposure would not have been adequate to the challenge. If everything that you've suggested were done or had been done, you know, prior to this whole sequence, would that have been enough in the case of Syria to actually make a difference, or would it still be too slow and the consequences still not grievous enough for being exposed?
I think it's a great question. The first thing I'll point out with Syria is that there has been no formal finding of non-compliance yet. My proposals are all about what happens when the Board of Governors confirms a finding of non-compliance, whether that's equivalent to NPT violations. But that hasn't happened yet with Syria. The board has not yet made a finding of non-compliance. Many of us think that the IAEA ought to ask for a special inspection at this point, and if that's refused, you then have sufficient grounds for a finding of non-compliance. But that's just a plug for another article. That's slightly by the by. So directly, these proposals would not have made much of a difference. The way they may have helped indirectly is the US and Israel had concerns about reporting the facilities to the to the IAEA because they thought that nothing was going to happen there. Now, they may have been right, they may have been wrong in their concerns. But the more you can provide, the more you can convince all states that safeguards violations will be acted upon seriously and robustly, the more likely they are to report findings to the IAEA rather than take matters into their own hands. So I don't claim that, as again, just to emphasize, I don't view these proposals as being a panacea that are all of a sudden just going to cure the entire system. But they are steps in the right direction. And the hope would be that if you can tighten up the system enough and all states are agreed on the principle that safeguards violations have to be dealt with seriously and robustly, then hopefully states will feel more willing to go to the IAEA rather than to take unilateral action. But as I say, I emphasize this is part of a big picture. This is a long process. I don't think kind of any proposals are going to solve that by itself. These are a step in the right direction. Ambassador Shorty.
That was a very good presentation with some very sound recommendations. I would like to pick up on Greg Thielman's using of Syria as a case study, which won't surprise you, but look at it differently. One of the conclusions the Syrian leadership has obviously come to is that the best way to avoid being found in violation of its safeguards obligations is just by to refuse flat out to cooperate with the IAEA. I mean, that's one of the reasons why one might consider a special inspection to sort of put them on the spot. But if you find countries following the Syrian example, which in a way has followed the Iranian example, and refusing to cooperate, at what point in your judgment does non-cooperation constitute non-compliance? Who makes that judgment? Is that the Director General? Is that the Board of Governors? Or is that something you think should also be taken up at the NPT conference? Thank you.
That's a very difficult question. Firstly, let me say I agree in principle that non-cooperation can be non-compliance. Article 19 of states of the safeguards agreement has the unable to verify provision. That is, if the IAEA is unable to verify that a state is in compliance, then the Board of Governors can find it in non-compliance. that actually pushes the onus on the state to prove it's compliant, not on the IEA to prove non-compliance. And that's very, very sensible because of exactly the problem of non-cooperation that you highlight. A state can, which is effectively what Syria has done, a state can simply stall an investigation by refusing to cooperate. And hence you could, if the onus was on the IAEA to prove compliance, you could, a state could just simply not cooperate and hence never be found in non-compliance. So I absolutely agree that non-cooperation at some point does constitute non-compliance. That's the easy part of the question. The hard part of the question is at what point does that determination get made and who has made it? I think the point at which the determination is made is the point at which the IAEA has said, we need you to do X, Y, and Z in order to verify you're under your obligations. And when a state then refuses to do X, Y, and Z, that's the point of non-compliance. I mean, this is part of what I see as the value in requesting a special inspection, is that the IAEA goes, look, here are all the uncertainties we have. We need access to these three sites, whatever. If Syria then refuses that, it would seem to me then exactly the right thing to invoke the unable to verify provision. As to who has the legal authority to do that? It's a two-stage process, isn't it? I mean, the safeguards inspectors report non-compliance to the DG, stage one, who then transmits it to the board, who then choose to confirm or otherwise. So essentially, I think both sides probably have to do this. I mean, the legal procedure is that as far as I see it, the safeguards inspectors are going to have to use their technical judgment to say non-cooperation is non-compliance, and then the board is going to have to confirm those. I think both of those links probably have to happen in practice. As to whether the review conference is the right place to deal with it, as with all of these things, if this is an area that non-nuclear weapon states would like to focus on, then I would absolutely take them up on that offer. I mean, it seems to me that there has to be a quid pro quo on both sides. And at the moment, my attitude would kind of be to say to the non-nuclear weapon states, we would like your help in all of these different areas. Pick the ones that you feel most comfortable to help us with in the first instance. So if there is willingness to confirm that non-cooperation does lead to non-compliance, then I would say go for that. I simply have no idea whether that's something that non-nuclear weapon states would do in 2010. Yes.
Thank you. Greg Giles, SAIC. I have a comment, a compliment, and a question in that order. The comment is to pick up on Syria. It's worth speculating if there is to be sort of a new regime, changing of the rules, whether the Syrian leadership might actually want to come clean now under the current implications of a finding of noncompliance versus a revised regime. So makes you wonder how that might play out. Really, James, is I've been following your work in this area, and I think you really should be complimented for your thought leadership. The question actually builds on Norm Wolf's question as far as the venue. Have you floated, your proposal in other capitals? How do you think it could play out at the RevCon? How do you think nations of the non-aligned movement might respond to it, European capitals, et cetera?
Firstly, thank you for the compliment. If I can comment on your comment, first of all, I think that the one thing I do feel very strongly about is just because a safeguards violation, even if you make a safeguards violation an NPT violation, that doesn't necessarily mean that sanctions would be appropriate. If a state cooperates fully and proactively with the agency, genuinely, if the agency is able to certify, in exactly the way that South Africa did when it dismantled its nuclear weapons program, and indeed as Libya did when it decided to make the decision to give up its nuclear weapons program, in that circumstance, then I think that punitive action wouldn't be merited by the Security Council. So it wouldn't necessarily be that if the review conference was to agree on this, then the Security Council would then put sanctions on Syria necessarily if it was found in non-compliance. I think you have to put the pressure on Syria to test its behavior. In terms of your question, I mean, I have floated this idea amongst various people, I mean, particularly here in Washington and in London, where I was there last week, and also at a conference when I was in Egypt earlier in the year. You get different reactions. I mean, the US and the British diplomats who I've spoken to have said they think it's a very interesting idea. Whether or not it goes any further than that remains to be seen. I mean, there's obviously a judgment call to be made on which initiatives you're going to push. Not surprisingly, I got very different reactions when I was floating this idea in Egypt. The message that I was getting back is, in principle, we are open to the quid pro quo, but what Egypt and other states in the Middle East expect on the disarmament front is potentially very hard to deliver. I mean, as you all know, different states stress different areas of disarmament they would like to see progress in. And in the case of the Middle East, it's particularly on the fulfillment of the WMD zone in the Middle East, at least movement towards that, which is is both important and very, very hard to make progress. So I don't think this is a proposal that, in principle, non-nuclear weapon states would be desperately opposed to. The question is whether or not there's enough of the quid pro quo this time round. I think it's often forgotten there's a lack of trust on both sides. The non-nuclear weapon states don't trust the nuclear weapon states to make good on the disarmament promise, and the nuclear weapon states don't trust the non-nuclear weapon states to make good on the non-pro promise. So whether or not that kind of circle can be squared this time round, I honestly don't know. There was a hand up. I can't see whose it is, but just, yeah. Yeah.
Mohammed Hanafi from the Embassy of Egypt. Just to pick up on what you just said. Not referring to what you said, but one of the means, effective means to strengthen the safeguards regime and to deter safeguard violations is to ensure that one rule applies to all. And I was a bit surprised that your paper didn't mention the need for in order to strengthen the safeguard regime, the need for all the nuclear facilities to be applied to the same rule and to be under the safeguards regime. And for some reason, the Israeli example comes to mind. What is your comment on that?
What I didn't want to do with this paper particularly was try to predict what the quid pro quo would look like, to try to predict what in the way of Article 6 the weapon states have to do to get the kind of political capital that would be needed for the proposals I wanted. As I said in the answer to the previous question, I recognize that different states have different demands, areas they would like to see progress in. In the case of Egypt, I absolutely understand it's in the area of the Middle East, and particularly on making progress towards the 95 resolution. So I absolutely understand that different countries' perspectives on Article 6 have to be taken into account. I wouldn't want to start predicting exactly what a quid pro quo should look like, because at the end of the day, if there is one, it's going to be hammered out by diplomats behind the scenes. But I do respect different states' concerns on different areas of Article 6 progress.
Paul Kerr from CRS. I just have one comment that I think might help sort out maybe the logic behind your proposal a little bit. It seems to me that the idea of finding safeguards violations, or basically making it easier to find states in noncompliance with the NPT, would have more utility in the case of sort of the lesser violations like the South Koreas of the world, as opposed to the Irans and North Koreas of the world. Because one instrument you didn't mention, or I think that bears mentioning, is is Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. Because, you know, the Security Council, regardless of the fact that Iran has not been found in violation of the NPT formally, the Security Council has acted, as we know. And I take your point that finding Iran formally in noncompliance with the NPT might increase at the margins the chances that, say, the Russians would do more. But
I don't think anybody would argue that that is the make or break on the Russian position regarding Iran in the Security Council. So it seems to me that at most you might get some marginal progress at the Security Council for the hard cases, the Irans of the world. But I think the greater utility is in sort of establishing more country-neutral rules, because I agree that the attitude or the actions regarding South Korea particularly have been problematic.
No, I mean, I appreciate your take on that. I think that, again, I mean, I've tried not to oversell what I think these proposals do. Every diplomat I've spoken to has told me that behind the scenes, Russia keeps on making this argument that NPT violations aren't safeguards violations. So if you did get agreement on this, would Russia have another excuse? Well, probably. But are you kind of pushing it in a direction where you might have some utility in enhancing sanctions on Iran? Well, again, I mean, I hope you would. Maybe I think there would be a bit more effect on Iran than you do. But again, I'm not particularly claiming that any of this is going to be an immediate game changer. But I hope it would help reconfigure the debate in a useful way. There's one other thing I would say about Iran, actually, which is that I'm very careful in the paper, and if I wasn't careful in my talk, then I go with what I said in the paper, to say that these proposals apply in future. And the reason I say in future is because I think realistically you're never going to get states to agree to something that they think is retrospective and is changing the goalposts on Iran. So if Iran was to commit further safeguards violations, these proposals would, of course, apply. But, I mean, I think it's important for the sake of not changing the goalposts in an ongoing game that the proposals only apply to future cases of safeguards violations. So I've deliberately kind of tailored them to make it look like I'm not targeting Iran. Any other questions? Yes.
My question is how, and you've talked about encouraging states to adopt the additional protocol, but how would your proposal, do you think, would affect those efforts to convince countries that have so far resisted in adopting the additional protocol to do so if they see that it's, I mean, obviously, for example, Egypt have seen it as asking for one additional commitment from a non-nuclear weapon state when progress might be lagging on disarmament, and this might be used to say, well, it make it even easier to increase obligations from non-nuclear weapon states. So my question is how would it affect efforts to encourage additional protocol?
In the short term, I don't think it would have much of an effect at all. I mean, getting countries to ratify additional protocols is an independent process of this. Beyond kind of broad language supporting the additional protocol, I don't think you're going to get much more than that at the review conference. What I hope you get in the longer run is kind of a cycle. I mean, I've talked about how you have two-way distrust at the moment. I hope that these kinds of proposals can lead to a virtuous circle rather than a vicious circle. At the end of the day, I believe that a lot of non-nuclear weapon states are genuine when they say that they're not ratifying the additional protocol because of a lack of progress in disarmament. And I think that having a virtuous circle where the non-weapon states are saying more and then doing more on disarmament and the non-weapon states are doing more on non-proliferation is exactly the kind of outcome that, I mean, a lot of us at Carnegie have been arguing for a long time and long before I have arrived here. So I think that that's the process you're trying to catalyze, and I see the NPT as being kind of I see the Security Council resolution this morning as being the first little modest step along that road. At the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that the Bush administration liked, and indeed one former official has been saying how they were all the Bush administration's ideas anyway. But the point remains that the Bush administration couldn't have got this resolution. So I see this as kind of the first positive sign that this kind of quid pro quo can be made to work. I hope we can build more at the review conference. And if you build that two-way trust, then you can get into this virtuous circle, which I hope will promote AP ratification at the end of the day. But, you know, I'd acknowledge that it's based on an assumption about why non-nuclear weapon states aren't doing more on non-proliferation. That remains to be seen whether it's correct.
I wanted to pick up on this recommendation to, you know, for a more country-neutral mm-hmm. approach, because it's one that has just vexed me as well. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on the steps that you think would move us in that direction, because, as you know, there different institutions have different cultures, and you know, they sort of fasten on to a few assumptions and trying to get them to even consider that they have those assumptions is really a big challenge in different institutions. So I wondered if you had any suggestions or had thought about what steps might be necessary to move in that direction.
And it's a very good question, a very hard one to answer. I think, you know, there's kind of two different aspects to the problem. First are the kind of technical measures. And I, in many ways, I consider what I presented today to be a technical measure. And my colleague Pierre, and I'm pretty sure some of his papers are on the table, has also talked about other of these kind of technical measures. The bigger political change that needs to happen is countries need to realize that it's in their own interests to be non-discriminatory in the way they do enforcement. I mean, let me give you an example. If you were to write down a list of the next 8 or 10 countries that you think are likely to proliferate, and we might disagree about which countries they are, but I bet you most of the countries on most of your list would be US allies. Or friends, US friends or allies. So it's actually, and that means to me that it's very much in the US interest to send out messages to its friends and allies that it's not going to let them get away with proliferation. The US actually has a key pivotal role to play in preventing proliferation, precisely because the next proliferator is probably going to be a US ally, whoever you think that is. Syria here. So I think it's in the US interest to be much more even-handed. And I think for similar reasons, it's in the Russian, it's in the Chinese interest, it's in the interest of the key states on the Security Council. How you convince them of that is a different story. I mean, how you make sure that broader non-proliferation considerations don't trump bilateral relationship considerations, which they tend to do pretty much all of the time. Seems to me that at the highest level, governments have to decide they're going to take non-proliferation much more seriously than they have done in the past. So I don't have a good answer to your question, because the most important thing is for countries to decide it's in their own interest, which I think it is, to deal with enforcing non-compliance in a much more even-handed, non-discriminatory way. But I don't have any bright ideas about how to affect that particular change. Yes.
EJ Cho with the Voice of America. What are some of the lessons that can be learned from the case of North Korea in preparing for the 2010 review conference?
I think the most important lesson from North Korea is about the way that you deal with withdrawal from the NPT. North Korea, as you know, is the only state to have withdrawn from the NPT, and the response to its withdrawal was lukewarm, to put it best. So the key lesson that I take away is that we need to strengthen the international community's response to states that withdraw from the NPT. That's not to say you can amend the treaty, because that's absolutely not on the table. But you can have a political agreement that the Security Council is going to deal with it and respond to it in a much more robust way, which incidentally we saw in the Security Council agreement this morning. I thought that was one of the highlights of the resolution this morning. So I view again Article 10 to be a fruitful issue to look at for the review conference, much more fruitful than enhancing safeguards or constraining Article 4 rights. I mean, you're not going to get anywhere on those issues, but you might on Article 10 rights. Yes, sir, at the back.
James, I agree wholeheartedly with what you've been saying. I think that the point that you've made over and over again is a problem of how do you implement this with some type of rigor or robustness. And so from my perspective, I think what we need to have is automatic sanctions. And what the Security Council does is determine whether those sanctions are adequate or should additional sanctions have been imposed, or if once the sanctions have been imposed, IAEA comes along and says, okay, they are doing what they said they will do, and so it's appropriate now to remove those sanctions, for the Security Council then to agree that it is appropriate to remove those sanctions. But I think, once again, it's similar to the analogy to me is if you're driving down a road and the speed limit is 65 and doing 80, you're going to get a ticket. So the same thing here. If someone is not abiding by either the safeguards agreement or the nonproliferation treaty, they're going to get sanctions against them for going against those treaties that they've signed. And the only way they get out of those sanctions is to do something to appropriately demonstrate that they want to live by the agreements that they've signed on to.
I mean, in many ways, automatic sanctions have long been the holy grail of in enforcement. And the problem, as you realize, of course, is that nobody's willing to agree to them. I have kind of two particular thoughts about automatic sanctions. Again, firstly, I think it is important to kind of use Sandy Spector's term to allow repentant nuclear proliferance. If a country breaks the rules but really genuinely cooperates completely and proactively with the IAEA, I actually don't think you want to sanction that country. Now, that doesn't, I think, necessarily negate the idea of automatic sanctions, because you could have the IAEA saying that there's non-cooperation and that could be the trigger. But I think it is important to allow countries that want to come back into the fold to do so. I keep on quoting Pierre, but I think he comes up with lots of very good ideas. The particular automaticity that Pierre Goldschmidt has argued for is if the Director General of the IAEA says he needs extra powers, then the Security Council does a generic resolution in advance to say that in that circumstance, it will give extra investigative, legally binding powers to the Director General. I think that's an incredibly clever idea, actually. And I think, it's not something I think is feasible in the short term, but in the longer term, as kind of a really good non-proliferation measure, if the Director General, after 30 days of an investigation, was to certify that there'd been non-cooperation and extra powers were needed, then a kind of promise of automaticity that would happen. That, I think, is a really interesting area of kind of the first step on the path to automatic sanctions. So I think in the longer run, that's an idea it's definitely worth looking very seriously at. Well, I don't see any more questions. It's normally customary for the person to chairing the meeting to sing the praises of the speaker. that might look a little bit big-headed in this particular case. So I will just thank you all for coming. If there's any food left outside, invite you to finish it off before you go.